This is June 13, 1998. We're in Austin, Texas, behind Jovita's restaurant, almost interviewing State Senator Gonzalo Barrientos. And you've executed that deed of gift form, and you understand what the interview is about.
I do.
All right. Let's start off with some family background. Your grandparents, both sides, if you remember who they were, where they were from, where they were born. Then your father and mother, how they met, who were they, their names, where they came from. And then you and your wife, children, or relationships, if you had some. Bring us up to date in terms of genealogy. Who is Gonzalo Barrientos?
Well, Gonzalo Barrientos is part of a lot of people over a lot of years. Mi abuelito, my grandfather, was born and came from originally Agualeguas, Nuevo León, as was my grandmother, Gallegos. Of course, they had been back and forth into Texas many years before that, and probably many years before that, their parents and grandparents. But they moved here in 1905, and my grandfather married Maria Gallegos. And from that came my father and seven brothers.
What was your grandfather's name?
My grandfather's name was Jesus Barrientos.
Okay.
And so he moved into the area about 35 miles east of Austin, which generally is called Bastrop, Texas, which will remind you of a very famous legal case, but we'll get into that later. North of Bastrop were two or three little villages, Calvin, or as they called it, Calvin, Texas, and Phelan, Texas. There were a lot of Mexican-American people living around there and made their living by mining coal. There were coal mines there that they dug into the ground. My father and some of my uncles worked in the coal mines until the late 30s when they were closed down. It was sub-bituminous coal and was too expensive to mine that type of coal. From there was my parents' marriage. My mother's name was Cristina Mendiola. And by that time, my grandfather and my uncles all together had bought about 20 acres north of Bastrop, El Rancho que le hicieron.
Let me interrupt you. Mendiola, is that spelled M-E-N or M-I-N?
M-E-N.
All right.
It's Mendiola is the correct. Mendiola, M-I-N, has been, I think, an offshoot of that, but the correct Spanish used is Mendiola. At any rate, my mom and dad were married, and since coal mines were closed and most of the other work were migrant work that they did at that time before I was born, they moved to Galveston, and my dad went to work on the ships, unloading bananas, cargo, etc. He was a longshoreman. I was born there during that time. Shortly after I was born, my father was in an accident on the ships and hurt his back, and so they moved back to Bastrop to the ranch, El Rancho, where about two of my uncles and two of my aunts were still living. My mother was sort of the caretaker for my grandfather. My grandmother had since passed away. And she would do the washing and the cooking and whatnot.
The ranch, was that the family property or tenant farming, sharecropping, or just
it workers? It was a family property which had been bought by my grandfather and all of his sons working together. It was about 20 acres. It was, well, we planted corn, watermelons, cucumbers. Remember, for a few years, we planted acres and acres of sweet potatoes. To this day, for some reason, I still like sweet potatoes in spite of all that. Planted some cotton there at some points. By this time, I have a sister who was born. Her name is Alicia Barrientos Now Fuentes, which also reminds me, prior to my being born, I had an older sister. Who passed away at birth. Moving along to the late 40s, early 50s, my situation was such that we grew up as migrant workers since I was, can remember, about 2 years old, up until past high school.
In-state?
Only in-state. It was very interesting because later, as I reflected, when I became 6 years old, my parents would return in September, while everybody else stayed out there till November, December. All the kids lost several months of school. My mom had maybe a year or so of formal education. So did my father. Of course, these were the old Mexican schools. They didn't go to school with the Anglos. But we were returned in September every year. There's so many things to talk about. I'm going to skip around a little bit here. But one of my uncles, my dad's brothers, was in the Second World War. He came back to live with us. Of course, when he came back, he had both of his legs blown off in one of the German battles and several fingers. So he was paraplegic. And I remember growing up on the farm, on the rancho, just pushing him around. At that time, we had no electricity, no water, no telephone. So we had an outhouse out there about 100 yards behind the house. And I remember once in a while pushing him out there on his chair to go to the toilet. That's when I was 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. He later married and moved to Austin. On my mother's side, one of my uncles was also in Germany. His name was Pedro Mendiola. He came back with no injuries except one German bayonet across his forehead. Some of the little things that, well, big things that you remember growing up. We would go on the migrant trails first to south to Sinton, Taft, Banquette, Bishop, then go back up through Bastrop, around Taylor, Elgin, Peck, Cotton there. Then we would go out to Tahoka, Paducah, Littlefield, Monday, all those areas around West Texas to pick cotton. It was colder than hell, I remember, sometimes. And other times it was hot as hell, too. Littlefield, Texas is interesting to me because I must have been, 5, 6, or 7. We would pick cotton until all week, you know, from about 5, 6 o'clock in the morning until about 6 o'clock in the evening. Break for lunch, of course. And then Saturdays, we would pick cotton until noon. Y luego el baño, we'd take our buckets of water and some shack and go bathe, and then everybody get in the trucks and go into town. I don't know what year this was, but I was about 5, 6, 7 years old. We went into this on the square in Littlefield, Texas, and I will never forget this. It was one of the few times it happened, but it was so just burned into my mind. We went into a cafe, not exactly a restaurant, those little places out there. My dad, my mom, my sister and I, and we went to this restaurant or the cafe and sat down and waited and waited and waited. And you know what's coming. After a while, the waitress came by and said that they didn't serve Mexicans. So I didn't know what was going on. I barely knew how to speak English. I could just see my dad and how he gritted his teeth and you see his jaw muscles and got up and walked out. But until later I found out, and I said, bigots. At any rate, we'd come back from the cotton fields to Bastrop. On the little farm, about 6 or 8 miles north of Bastrop, right next to the farm was a 2 or 3 room schoolhouse for black children. And I learned to speak English two ways. One was when we came back from the migrant trails, it was wintertime, and we weren't in school yet. On a wooden door, my father had put the ABCs in Spanish. And he would take a little ruler and point to each letter, and I was 4 or 5 years old and I learned the alphabet. Matter of fact, I learned how to read Spanish and write Spanish before English from that. But I learned from those letters. And the English language, when I went to play with the black children about a quarter mile down the hill on the farm, and so I learned to speak English there. It was interesting because I think because of that, I didn't grow up with very much of an accent, a Spanish language accent. When it came time for me to go to school, turns out that there were three schools in Bastrop, one for blacks, one for Mexicans, and one for whites. And of course, I was going to school with the Mexicans. Soon after I started school in Bastrop, and of course the schoolroom was pura raza, pura Mexicanos, and 10 or 20 or 30 people, and all I can remember is the teacher almost every day is giving us a sheet of paper and telling us to draw with a crayon. I think they had the ABCs up above the blackboard, but that's about all I remember. At any rate.
Was it a one-room school?
Three-room. Three-room school. It was...
Did you get bused?
We did ride the bus. They did allow us to ride the bus from out there 7 or 8 miles north of Bastrop, which is another phase of this school situation. 2 or 3 years after I was there, there was a little girl whose name was Minerva Delgado. She was in about the third grade, older than I am. And apparently the old attorney, Gustavo Garcia from San Antonio, and a couple of other folks from the civil rights organizations, took her case to the Texas Supreme Court on the basis of segregation. And that case was called Delgado versus Bastrop, from Little Minerva Delgado, who, by the way, today is a school teacher who has taught bilingual education in San Antonio and is now teaching in Houston still. At any rate, that case was won, and the Supreme Court of Texas found that thereafter no Mexican-American child would be segregated in schools. So the next year I found myself going to school with all the little white kids, which was an interesting phenomenon. People talk about biculturalism, bilingualism and all that, where you're living two cultures, two lives almost. I lived it. On the one hand, you had your little Johnny Rednecks, who would call you spick, greaser, taco bender, and all that. And of course it hurt, so you duke it out. Now that duking it out got a little tougher as you got to the 6th grade, and to the 8th grade, and to the 12th grade, because the hits got stronger and hurt more.
They got bigger and...
They got bigger and meaner. On the other hand, because I could speak English, from learning from the black kids, I got along with the little white kids a little better than some of my brothers and sisters, Chicanos. Consequently, as I got into the 5th, 6th, 7th grade, there'd be a couple of chucos who would say, es vendido, que nomás quieres andar con los gringos, and all that kind of stuff. So you duke it out with them. So you talk about a biculturalism, friatazos from both lados. Anyway, got through all of that. Faced, like many Chicanos, the problems one faces in the public schools. You had the books, which you had your George Washingtons, you had your Davy Crockett's, all of the things that we've even given speeches about over the years. And of course, any Mexican portrayals, they were ugly and big mustaches and dirty. And wanted to kill white people. Well, we got through all of that because back home I had the backup of my mom and dad and my grandfather, who were telling me the truth about history. In addition, we were not allowed to speak Spanish. We would get punished, put into a corner, or even paddled if we spoke Spanish. I got through all of that. I even got to play Little League. And because of my father and mother, what would happen is that it would bring us back from the Piscas and the Saikis, put us in school, and they would go off 50 miles away to pick cotton or chop cotton. They would come in and in the evening take me to go play ball, which from where we lived at Rancho into town was about 6-7 miles. So after they came back from work, they'd take me to go play ball. Imagine how tired they were and all that. At any rate, I was very lucky simply because a lot of kids don't have a mom and dad that we had. They even bought me a trumpet and I played in the band. I participated in all the things because I thought that in spite of all the things we've been through, I could compete with those individuals, and played in the band, ran track, played football, played baseball, I remember my junior year, we had just gotten a TV set in 1956, 57, something like that, and I had been watching this TV show called West Point, and I decided I wanted to go to West Point because of my uncle's cousins who had been in the military. Until they told me that to go to West Point, you had to be appointed by a congressman. And the congressman in that district was an Anglo, and I didn't believe he was about to appoint any Chicano to West Point. So I gave that up. Graduated from high school there in Bastrop. There were 27 of us in the graduating class. I think there were about three, four Chicanos at the most out of 27. Took the test at the University of Texas, got married, had met a young woman in Galveston named Emma Serrato, who the Serrato family had previously been from Central Texas. Of course, they had been migrants too. At any rate, came to the University of Texas and had to work full time. Sometimes I was polishing boat decks for Glastron. Sometimes I was waiting on tables at the old Jalisco Cafe, a restaurant. Sometimes I was flipping hamburgers for the holiday houses. I also worked as a research assistant to the Ed Psych department. I worked as a dorm worker for the mentally retarded out of Travis State School. And why don't we take a little break? Because I need a drink of water.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you said you had gotten married. You said you had come to college. You said you'd worked in all these places. You had mentioned about 7 or 8 places you had worked. And then you asked for a drink of water. Okay. Any children right away?
Are we on?
Yes, you're on now.
Okay. Well, I guess by the time I was at the end of my freshman year at the University of Texas, we had our first child. His name is Joseph. And we can go into what he's doing now and all that later. The University of Texas was interesting for me because, number one, most of the subjects were not easy, but not very, very difficult.
What year was this?
61 to 65.
Okay. You graduated in 60?
Right.
And you were born when?
1941.
Okay.
In Bastrop, I was not number one in the class. I think I was about number four, number three or four, something like that. I had A's pretty much, and some B's. What they didn't teach us in Bastrop, however, was how to write. We had a good foundation in English and structure and outlining sentences and grammar and all that. But they didn't teach us how to write at all. So when I went to the University of Texas, it was a shock. As a matter of fact, I think that was my toughest situation I went through at the University of Texas, English 601, writing. I first took that course and made a D in it. And I said, well, that's not good enough for me, so I went back and took it again. I flunked it. I went back and took it again, and I could see that possibly I was going to flunk it again, so I dropped it. So I went to the department head, and I said, look, you're allowing some of these students to take English for foreign students. Why can't I do that? He said, oh, no, you can't do that. You're not a foreign student. I said, okay. Well, then I want to take Spanish, freshman Spanish. He said, oh, no, you can't do that. You're a native speaker. So there's where you start getting screwed both ways. Not that I hadn't seen it before. I was trying to bring up the grade point average. At any rate, I took a bunch of courses, sociology, psychology, government, economics, math, you name it. I was at the University of Texas about 4 years, in and out. I was on SCOPRO. I was working full-time, but this time I had 3 kids. And
you had given up on West Point because of lack of faith in the system that you'd get appointed. So you gave up that dream. You went to college pursuing what dream? What did you want to be then?
It was really interesting because the last year that we went out on the migrant trail, I was in the 11th grade. And that year, I had some cousins in Galveston who persuaded me to go over there for the summer. They were all waiters, busboys, bartenders. And so when I went over there, I worked as a busboy at the large hotels over there. The Jack Tar, the Buccaneer, the Galvez, the Balinese Room. And it's quite different from being out in the 100-degree sun, sweating with a big hat, burned, and working from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night, to being in an air-conditioned hotel with thick carpet, clean fingernails, white uniform with green stripes. That was not work, that was pleasure, and you got paid for it. So I decided that I wanted some of that good life, and I came to the University of Texas and said, I'm gonna set the world on fire. Matter of fact, I started out in my major in restaurant and hotel management. And pretty soon, I kept remembering all the life that I'd been through before and some of the things that I was seeing then. So I gave that up and started into sociology, psychology, and the what was going on around the civil rights movement beginning, for me anyway, in the early 60s. While I was in school, it was interesting that Vietnam was going on, and I tried to enlist because of military history in the family.
Even with a wife and 1 to 3 kids?
Well, that was the situation. We had about, I think, one child at that time. Went to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. Said, nope, we can't use you because you have a child. And reflecting, thank goodness that I had a child because I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. At any rate, we by that time we were participating in a number of efforts, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. I found out soon afterwards that that war wasn't what it was made out to be, and it was a very wrong war, and I was out in the streets trying to convince other people to get the hell out of Vietnam.
Let me interrupt you and ask you, did you have any knowledge or participation in the Viva Kennedy clubs of the 60s?
Oh, yeah.
Or heard of Jeff Forum or LULAC? You went through that Bastrop thing, but you probably were too young to know what all it meant.
At the time I was too young. Later I do remember my grandfather. I still have some of the letters. You will remember the young soldier Longoria, who was to be buried in Three Rivers, Texas, but was not allowed to be buried there because they wouldn't bury Mexicans in the white cemetery. I have a letter from Dr. Hector P. Garcia to my grandfather asking for contributions to send the young man to be buried in Arlington, which my grandfather and the family sent some money. This was back in the 40s sometime, I think. Still have that letter, as a matter of fact. It's an interesting part of my life and the things that I keep. So I remember some issues like that that came up during the time when I was very, very young. When I was in high school, I played the trumpet, and I was in the band, and I remember the band being taken out to the American Legion, where this fellow named Lyndon B. Johnson was going to come and was running for president. Of course, I had been listening to Kennedy's speeches at that time in high school. I remember playing the trumpet for about an hour, playing over and over again, "Happy Days Are Here Again." And all these people with signs saying LBJ all the way, just marching around after having had a few drinks, I suppose, because they were very happy, around and around for about an hour. And after we finished playing, they stopped and went back to the bar. All the band members went to meet this tall guy with a big nose, which was kind of red at the time. I think he had a couple of beers. And that's when I met Lyndon Johnson. So soon after, I got enthused about Kennedy and how Kennedy approached Latin America, Mexico, and the Mexican Americans, and was involved in going door to door for passing out literature and bumper stickers and all that for the Kennedys. Soon after he was elected, his speeches, I think, made a difference in what I wanted to do. He's one of those people that seemed to cross ethnic lines and cultures that reach out to what really is the meaning of life and what to do about life and life's problems and the brothers and sisters that one meets. At any rate, I later met many of the Kennedys, but I'm skipping around here. Why don't you ask me some questions?
At Austin UT, did you meet the Carlos Castañeda or Américo Paredes, some of those early intellectuals and somewhat civil rights leaders?
During those years, it was very difficult to get to know anybody other than some of your camaradas that you were going to school with. Number one, you had to work your butt off to pay for, to make a living and to pay for tuition and to study. And one was made to feel like you were just a number over there. You were just one out of thousands and thousands of people. So I never heard at the time that I was there of any civil rights efforts. Some of us are just like right now, some of the students are trying to make it. They're just too busy studying and trying to pay their rent and trying to pay for food and trying to pay for tuition.
Did you get involved with PASO after the Kennedy election that formed?
Very little at that time because of the kids that we had. By then we had about two, and working full-time. My wife was working full-time, and I was working full-time and going to school.
Well, who were the other two children? What are their names?
Well, the first one was Joseph, Gonzalo Joseph Barrientos. So it's Joseph. The second one was Angelina. Third one was Alicia. And the fourth one was Adelita. Adelita just graduated a couple of years ago from A&M. Joseph went to the University of Houston 1 year, came back to the University of Texas, went to UT Law School, married a young lady from Corpus Christi who had gone to Yale and came back to law school, so they're both graduates. He was an assistant county attorney, assistant district attorney, and is now in Corpus Christi as a law partner to David Perry, practicing whatever kind of law.
Personal injury.
Personal injury law. She is ran for a judge last year and is now a JP in Corpus Christi.
What's her name?
Lisa Gonzalez. Angelina went straight into working and I guess grew up with us in the civil rights days and all the marches because she's still involved in running people's campaigns and registering voters.
Where is she?
She is in Austin. Alicia went to Southwest Texas. She is a caseworker and a manager now of caseworkers for the Department of Human Services. And Adelita went to Texas A&M and is a department head of fiscal notes for the Attorney General's office. And there was a young lady that came into our lives many years ago. She was about 5 years old. Came from a broken family in Houston. We brought her over here and did not formally adopt her. She was taken back to Houston, but then came back with us and grew up with us, and her name is Virgie. And she is the information clerk at the Travis County Courthouse. If you ever go to the courthouse, you will not miss her because she's got a smile that big and more energy than you can imagine, and she's about that tall.
What's her name?
Virgie.
Virgie?
Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. Uh-huh. What?
She it was San Jaramillo. She changed her name to Barrientos.
So when did you graduate from UT Austin, and did you get your degree in psychology, or what did you end up doing?
I went to UT for about 5 years, and I never got a degree.
All right.
I'm not going to say like someone else has said in the past. I think I got a pretty good education, but I did not get a degree. However, now there are PhDs and the chancellor, and even though I don't have a degree from UT, they come to me to ask for money for their budgets.
All right, so after college, I assume you stopped doing all these other work in these restaurants and these places. This should be around now 63. Do you remember the Crystal City Revolt? Did you ever hear any of that?
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
The farm worker strikes and beginning in 65
sure.
And like I said, the farms and all that?
Sure.
What did you do or what were you doing?
By that time, around 64, we had heard of all of that. In 64, 65, I was involved over here with the boycotts on the different products for the farm workers. In 64, I was called and asked to if I would go to work as a community organizer for the National Urban League. And I started to get into the civil rights more and more, so I did and got the training for the community organization from the National Urban League and some of the Alinsky training there.
Organizing here in Austin.
Organizing in Austin. It was organizing in the east side of Austin, in Montoples, in Black East Austin, in St. John's, in Clarksville, which was a little pocket of poverty of African Americans in West Austin, very interesting. An old plantation left over there. It's gone now. I was there for about a year and a half. Funding ran out. I was asked to train VISTA volunteers at that point, and I was working for a contract out of Washington training VISTA volunteers. All in the meantime, there was participation in the different marchas and evolution of the movimiento going on in different parts of Texas, from Austin to the Valley to Cristal, different parts of Texas. Here in Austin, one of the things that kicked it off was La Huelga, the economy furniture.
Can you talk a little bit about that, what that was, and who were some of the principals and the issues?
There were some areas, specifically here in Central Texas, where most of La Raza, the Mexicanos, worked. One of those places was the economy furniture factory, where they built furniture, chairs, sofas, what have you. In 1 year, I think it was in the mid-60s, there was some organization for a union over there, and the owners were very adamant that they were not going to unionize. And the more adamant the owners got, the more amachados that the workers and we in the community got. So there was a strike, extended strike. It had a profound effect on the workers, but also on the Hispanic, the Mexican American community here in Austin, in terms of rallying for a cause that was right and just and very clear as to what people should do. And around that began to revolve the other issues of the farm workers, the civil rights movement, and then eventually running for office for several of us. So that was what the economy furniture strike was about.
Okay, well, I remember, I guess, does this conclude the genealogy, the biography? Is there any other significant thing about your family that you want to mention?
Yes. I'm glad you reminded me. Several years ago, I had known that my grandfather had come from Aguadas, Nuevo León. By the way, there was a president from there, Salinas, that had come from there also. At any rate, I took my father down there, because my mom has passed away about 5 years ago from diabetes. And I took my father down there and some of my kids, the family, and to meet some of the barrientos over there, and still have some primos. Don't know them very well, but we got to know each other fairly well. And some of them are very poor, and some of them are fairly middle class, air conditioning and stuff like that. No rich ones. And I met this old man who told me that I'd had a great, great, great uncle or something like that, whose name was Leandro Barrientos, who had fought in the U.S. Civil War. And I said, I don't think so. He says, no, he fought in the U.S. Civil War, because his widow would travel from Aguadas to Laredo, Nuevo, to Laredo, every month to pick up a check. And I thought, if it happens to be true, he must have fought for the North, because the South didn't have any money to pay their retiree soldiers any kind of money like that. So I forgot about it. Several years later, I was in El Paso. While in the Senate, I had passed a constitutional amendment to expand the student loan program by $300 million for bonds, and you have to get the constitutional okay from the people of Texas. So I was going around all over the state asking, having press conferences, asking people to vote for this $300 million for student loans. And after the press conference, I was in the president's office at UTEP, Natalicio, President Natalicio. And she had us eat lunch there in this room, and around the room, they had UT El Paso Press books that they publish. And I went up and I saw a book, and it said, Mexican Texans in the Union Army. And I opened it up to the back, and sure enough, there was Leandro Barrientos, 1863-1864, Aguadas, Nuevo León. And I said, I'll be darned. I had a relative who fought for the North to free the slaves in the Civil War. And I keep finding out things like that, like a lot of people do.
In part of the early conversation of genealogy, you mixed very well a lot of the early childhood. Is there anything significant or outstanding that you want to mention about early childhood before we get into your career, because you covered two areas in one? Good teachers, bad teachers, happy moments, ugly moments, lost dreams, new discovered heroes, church activities, dating, dancing, car hopping, low riding, fights at the drive-in.
First of all, I think as a child, when you're 6, 7, 8 years old, and I think people forget how very painful it can be, or adults can be, to mean and how very painful the effect can be for children. One of the things you never forget is how other kids or adults, just by words, hurt you very, very much, and you never forget those things. That's why I keep doing battle with some of these narrow-minded individuals who have no idea what a certain kind of pain is. I think that's one of the things that I will never forget, and I don't think other children, having gone through some of those things, will ever forget. And that's why we have to do something about that. Teachers, there were some very mean ones and some very good ones. There were some very mean teachers who went out of their way to put you down, to make you feel inferior, to hurt you. And you talk about an adult who does that to a child. I mean, that's damned evil. Then there were some very good ones. Of course, we never had any African-American teachers or Mexican-American teachers. They were all white. But I can remember a couple of people who were very, very much human beings and would tell me not to give up and to keep going. Clara Perkins, B.J. Wolf, who is now or was a coach here at Travis High School and is retired. But not a whole lot of those good teachers.
All right, well then, if you think of something, you bring it up. I'm going to skip over now to the third area, which is your political career, but be expansive, because the recollection that I have of first meeting you was as that Vista trainer when, in conjunction with the Mexican-American Youth Organization, a program called Vista Minority Mobilization was developed, and you and Merle Smith. Were the contact people. Were you ever involved with Mayo, or what was the relationship, or how did that contract come about, or how did that program come about, and from there you'll take it to your political career and to the electoral office.
After I had been training Vista and some Peace Corps volunteers for a year or two, I was asked if I would apply for a position with federal government, the Vista regional office. So I applied and was hired as a program officer for the Southwest. In working the Southwest, it was my responsibility to establish and oversee Vista programs throughout Texas. Later, it was too big, so I took only half of Texas. The Vista Volunteer Program was like the domestic Peace Corps. We would take individuals who would volunteer for 1 year, train them, and put them into barrios or ghettos wherever there was poverty, to do tutoring, to do community organization, to do whatever could be done to empower individuals who were in the lower economic levels. In doing this, I noticed a certain phenomena that we would get some very good volunteers from New York, from Connecticut, from Chicago, from Oregon, mostly young, white, idealistic people, most with a good intention to come down here and do what they could with the spirit that John Kennedy had instilled previously of what you could do for your country, not what your country could do for you. Except that it took about 6 months to train these individuals, put them into the community, and forget after so much work that they could only spend several months there and then they'd have to go back home. So you would take money to train them. You had to pay them around $200 a month. And then they were gone, unless they re-enlisted, which sometimes was the case and sometimes was not. If they did not re-enlist, you had an individual who had been there for a few months of training, and in the community, learning what the culture was, learning a little bit of the language, and then eventually not spending that much time there. So I went back to the regional office to the director and said, look, this is well-intentioned, but we're not getting the maximum for the dollars that we're spending. Why don't we take the same amount of money, take individuals who live in the community, young people, middle-aged people, older people, and then train them and keep them in the community. They already know the culture, they already know the language, and then afterwards they still continue living there and hopefully doing the same things. Well, we got it written up. Bill Hale helped me on that, took it to Washington, and we got it funded for $1 million+. We called it Minority Mobilization.
What year was this?
1968, 69. After we got it funded, along with some friends that we had met in the VISTA program in the civil rights movement, we developed a curriculum which was different from the normal VISTA training, insofar as we took the idea of the crucios and that training and concentration on religion and used that same style on culture, pride, history of the Mexican-American people to instill a pride, a desire, a ganas to resolve some of the very painful problems that the Mexican-American community had. Then we added to that specific skills in community organization, in resource development, in economic development, in cooperatives development, and any other area that we could teach specifically to get some results. Putting that together into those volunteers, they came out generally like gangbusters, out there hollering for la causa and doing something about it. And we established those programs in El Paso, in Del Rio, in Laredo, in the Valley, San Antonio. And we were doing pretty darn well, I think. The best use of federal dollars that I've seen for a while, because it produced some results. It certainly received some attention. So much attention such that when we had set up the one in Del Rio, the establishment Anglo would be complaining about it as a communist propaganda and a communist front to bring down the great government of Texas. They exaggerated, to say the least. All it was individuals speaking for their rights and their liberties and trying to participate in government like the American Dream tells us to do. Except that they went to the governor, and the governor had the ability to pull a program. So they went to Governor Preston Smith and pulled the VISTA program out of Del Rio.
Senator, let me stop you there because it's a convenient breaking point. My 1 o'clock appointment is here. Let me.
Paramos ahí, just remind me that it was Del Rio, and then we'll take it from there.